From the heart of Big Ten country, Los Angeles, California, Ryan Abraham and David Woods present the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 24/7 Sports Network. Get together, we make the Podcast of Champions, talking all things Big Ten football. I keep wanting to say Pac-12 football, since Dave just informed me this is like our ninth year doing this. First year doing it in the Big Ten, and we're getting through our season previews. We got a couple big hitters this week. We got Penn State and Iowa, and we have Daniel Gallen from Lions 247, who's going to talk all about the Penn State Nittany Lions from my neck of the woods where I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. But Daniel, how you doing, man? Thanks for coming on.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me today.
So we're excited to talk about Penn State. I'm thinking for a lot of reasons, this could be a huge year for Penn State. And we'll get to some of them, including the schedule going into this. But I wanted to start just with some big changes for what is a program that's, I would say, in pretty darn good shape, but new coordinators on both sides of the ball. Tom Allen coming in on defense, formerly a head coach, and then Andy Kotelnicki. I'm going to pronounce that. Going to hope for the best. What do you think of those two hires, and how have they made an impact so far?
Yeah, I think you can look at both of these hires through kind of different sides of the same coin, maybe. With Tom Allen coming in, he's taking over a defense that was one of the best in the country last year under Manny Diaz. And, there James Franklin was looking for someone to kind of keep the continuity, someone who, wouldn't need to overhaul the personnel to fit his scheme. And then this is the most talent Tom Allen has ever had to work with. This isn't the Indiana roster anymore where you have to kind of create bespoke roles for different guys to maximize what they're able to do. You got Abdul Carter, you got Denai Dennis Sutton, you've got a couple five stars on this defense, and that's kind of where you start from. And then the other side with Andy Kotelnicki, it's kind of the you're basically rebuilding it from the ground up. I mean, this offense was not good under Mike Yurcich last year, especially in the biggest games of the year, Michigan, Ohio State, Ole Miss in the bowl game, even though you asterisk that with some of the opt-outs Penn State had. But Penn State is looking for an offense that can generate explosive plays, maximize what this talent can do, and kind of get the most out of Drew Aller, five-star quarterback, 24/7's the number one quarterback in the class of 2022, who kind of shrunk away against Ohio State and Michigan. So Penn State is looking for someone who can have a creative offense that can generate some big plays and get the most out of some of the players that Penn State has on that side of the ball. And we saw what Andy Kotelnicki did at Kansas. It's kind of the same thing. What can he do with more talent at a place like Penn State?
What's interesting about something you said there, and I think it's important for context for a lot of people, is expectations are a little bit different at schools like Penn State, because you mentioned the offense being not good last year. This was a top 25 offense in points per drive last season. They were 21st in points per drive. But the thing is, having watched a little bit of Penn State, I agree with you because it's relative to talent level. Mm-hmm. But what are the expectations? Like, give people an insight into what expectations are, in state college for this team and for kind of the program generally, when you're saying an offense that was top 25 is, something that they needed a full changeover.
And we are talking to Iowa next. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, for a certain segment of people, I think 10-2 as your ceiling, it kind of gets old. Penn State hasn't beaten Ohio State since 2016. They've lost three straight to Michigan. And for a little while, both teams had down 2020s, but it looked like Penn State was in that position to, be that number two, behind Ohio State in the Big Ten East. And then over the past 3 years, Michigan, really flipped the script on, pretty much everyone on that side of the, conference. And so, I think that at a certain point, 10-2, that being your ceiling, I think can get pretty frustrating, especially with in the 4-team playoff where, you pretty much always had to be a one-loss team to get in. You know, it'd be, you'd need a really specific set of circumstances. And for Penn State, if you were 10-2, you were most likely in third place in the Big Ten East. So there was really, really no path through. So, you know, I think that people are kind of wanting to take that next step. You know, I think that, you know, what, there's 134 FBS schools, and, you know, more than 100 would probably take what Penn State has right now. But at the same time, you know, James Franklin has, you know, acknowledged what the expectations are. And, you know, to kind of take that next step, to kind of break through, Penn State is one of those programs that is going to really be helped by the expanded playoff. You know, I think that, you know, there's something where, you know, I forget the exact number, but they would have been in it over these past couple of years. So I think that that's kind of what the people are waiting for, what people want to see. They want to see that next step. They want to see Penn State in the postseason beyond just a New Year's Six game.
Yeah, that's, I know when the powers that be came together to create the expanded college football playoff, like Jack Swarbrick from Notre Dame was there, pretty much set themselves up. Hey, the number five seed looks like better than the number one seed. It's not bad. You know, you get to play a group of five team in the first round and host a game and all that, and they don't have to play a conference championship game. But the other team I think that this is tailor-made for, it seems like Penn State, where if you're a perennial 10-2 team, you are in this field. So if that can happen and it's another 10-2 type of season and Penn State makes it in, where's the fan base level as far as, like, you know, happiness and satisfaction? And then how long can that go on if it's a one and done, like 2 or 3 years in a row or something, where it's like, hey, 10-2, still doing it, still making the playoffs, but aren't, you know, pushing forward anymore? Would that get old, if in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, people want national championships here. You know, that's kind of the standard. And, you know, there's been certain teams in the past couple of decades that have come close and then for a variety of reasons, you know, haven't gotten the right poll to vote for them, or, you know, I think 94 always comes to mind, you know, those sorts of things. And so, you know, I do think that there would be a lot of excitement for Penn State to get in right away. You know, they've already talked about, it's already been a topic of conversation, like if Penn State is hosting a playoff game at Beaver Stadium that third weekend in December, like, is it going to be a whiteout? What's the weather like? You know, could it be snowing in the whiteout? You know, James Franklin sounded, you know, pretty tickled at that possibility. And so, you know, I think that people, you know, I think there would be excitement, like with a lot of this stuff, there's kind of novelty, you know, the first time that you get to host a playoff game and everything. But there is going to be a point where people want to see results. And that's kind of the, I guess, the crux of it when you look long term. But, you know, I do think that this is a healthy program right now. I think the hires they made this offseason were, you know, really good. And they've continued to recruit at a, you know, pretty good level that should have them in the mix to compete. And, you know, we'll see how it looks on the field this fall.
All right, let's dive into that offense a little bit, because I think as we've been kind of circling, that's probably the biggest area for improvement. Offensive line, I think it's losing three starters, but returning, obviously, quarterback Drew Aller, running back Nick Singleton, Julian Fleming, tight end Tyler Warren. First, on the offensive line, what have you seen so far out of the offseason? You know, are there definite replacements already? Are those still competitions to be worked out? And second, with all that talent, do you see this potentially being a top 10 offense this year?
Starting with the offensive line, I mean, you've got to replace a first round pick in Olu Fashanu at left tackle, a third round pick in Caden Wallace at right tackle. You know, Wallace was someone who entered last year in a competition and solidified himself at that job and really had the best year of his career. He was really good last year, a breakout player. And then you're replacing your center, Hunter Norzad. The only spot right now where it seems like there's the one for one replacement is set is that. And Nick Dawkins, he's a fifth-year senior. He looks to be on track to start at center. He's had some injuries earlier in his career. He's been healthy for, you know, the past 2.5 years, I think, and is, you know, kind of in position right now to, you know, take over that spot. He's a great communicator, which you need at your center, and he just has a ton of experience from being around for so long. Tackle positions are still up in the air a little bit. I think at left tackle, you know, Drew Shelton started the last five games of the 2022 season when Fashanu went down with a knee injury. And but he was sidelined this spring after he had postseason surgery. So Javen Williams, who's a former five-star recruit, got a ton of work at left tackle, and James Franklin said that he thinks that Williams deserves some legit reps. So Shelton and Williams are competing on the left side. And then on the right side, you have Nolan Rushi, who transferred in from Wisconsin, former five-star recruit, number one player in Pennsylvania in the class of 2021. I think he really only played a half of football during his 3 years at Wisconsin. So he's come in, put on weight, and he's like 6'8", and came in at like 295, and they've got him up to 320. For whatever reason, they said Wisconsin couldn't keep the weight on him, which is interesting given that program's history. But he's competing with redshirt freshman Anthony Donka, who came in as a guard and exclusively worked as guard at guard last year as a freshman until bowl prep, when they were like, let's see what you can do at right tackle. And he plays the whole second half after Caden Wallace, kind of makes his cameo, and before the opt-out kicks in. And Donka was really good in that second half. I mean, he's massive, listed at 336, just a mountain of a young man. And, so those two are competing. And so, going in, you feel pretty good about the kind of the talent level that Penn State has on the offensive line, but how that actually works, replacing those starters, kind of figuring out that five. Penn State will rotate if they feel they can, or that players deserve to. We've seen that a lot at guard over the past couple of years. So we'll kind of see how that plays out. And then just to touch on the skill talent that Penn State has behind them, it starts with Nick Singleton and Katron Allen. I think that's one of the best running back duos in the country. You hope that Julian Fleming can raise the floor of that wide receiver room, but they need guys like Trey Wallace, Caden Saunders, Liam Clifford to kind of step up. Omari Evans is a junior who has flashed a little bit, has 4.31 speed. They need those kinds of guys to step up. I mean, Tyler Warren is going to be one of the best tight ends in the country, really reliable for Drew Aller, but they're going to need some outside playmaking. And that's, I think, where Trey Wallace, Harrison Wallace III is someone that you kind of set your eyes on a little bit.
Going over, to the defensive side of the ball, it's been tough as far as adding people in the portal at like the defensive tackle spots, but it looks like Penn State brings some guys back. I think half six starters or so off of the defense that were eligible for the NFL for the draft there. Where does kind of Penn State stand on the defensive side, and maybe some of the additions that they brought in through the portal?
Yeah, I mean, you feel really good about where they are, especially on the defensive line. You lose Adisa Isaac, who was a third round pick, Chop Robinson, who was a first round pick, at the defensive end spots. And then you think about Abdul Carter, who could be one of the best defenders in the country, is getting some really high level first round buzz for next year. And Denai Dennis Sutton, who is a five-star recruit in the class of 2022. Those are the next guys up. And so you feel really good about that. At defensive tackle, you've got two 6th-year seniors in the middle. And I think that there's a benefit to having, grown men pretty much at the line spots, veterans like that. And then on the back end, you've got KJ Winston, Jalen Reed, Zachy Wheatley. That's your top three safeties. They're all going to play. Tom Allen runs a 4-2-5, so you're going to see some unique personnel combinations. And Penn State just has so many defensive backs. You talk about adding through the portal. Penn State added a pair of cornerbacks, AJ Harris from Georgia, who's a sophomore. He was a five-star in the class of 2023. And Jalen Kimber from Florida, who began his career at Georgia. They both came in from the portal, and James Franklin and Tom Allen have said they feel like they have six guys that can start, that can play a lot, given what was already on the roster when those guys came in. So it's a really, really deep group. I think that you have some depth concerns at linebacker a little bit. There's some guys who might have to grow up. Penn State has a young linebacker, Keon Wiley, working his way back from injury. Kavion Keys was a redshirt freshman who was supposed to have a big role. He got removed from the university over some off-field stuff earlier. So there, is a little bit of depth there, but issue there. But at the top, I mean, Kobe King is a fourth-year guy, team captain material. And Tony Rojas is the name to circle as kind of next up at LBU.
I want to dive into that schedule because I think obviously there's a lot of reasons for optimism, I think, surrounding, a fresh, perspective at offensive coordinator, but the schedule might be the number one because for the first time in forever. Penn State doesn't have to play Michigan and also avoids Oregon. So only has to play Ohio State among the perceived top four in the league, which includes Penn State. You know, analyzing the schedules of the four, you know, projected to be in the top four of the league, Penn State probably has the softest in that they only have to play one of the other three. And then looking at the way the schedule sets up, obviously, you know, playing West Virginia in the opener is maybe not ideal because West Virginia is actually, you know, generally decent, but still an eminently winnable game. And then it's a pretty easy ramp up into the meat of the schedule, you know, with those four after that. And yes, I'm including UCLA among the easy ramp up for Penn State. but what's your general thought on this schedule? Because this looks like something where Penn State should be in the absolute thick of the conference race heading into the final weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it sets up nicely. You know, you talk about missing Michigan and kind of always having Ohio State and Michigan as the two headliners on the schedule. You know, theoretically, you know, it should be Ohio State and then like USC or Washington. You know, it feels like on paper should be one of those teams, but because of where those programs are, I think that Penn State gets them at, you know, a good time this year. And, you know, those are two, you know, pretty winnable games.
But, yeah, USC is terrible.
Yeah, I just think that the schedule, yeah, that West that West Virginia game to start, Penn State pulled away from them last year, looked really good. Happened to be their best game through the air of the season. But it just feels like a little bit of a tricky game given how West Virginia closed the year. It's on the road at noon in Morgantown. You know, that place is going to be ready to go. And then you're still breaking in a, you know, brand new offense, brand new defense. They also have brand new special teams coordinator this year too. So there's kind of, you know, other things that really factor in there. I mean, I think that Penn State should be favored and I think they'll win that game, but we're going to learn a lot. And it, you know, we've talked about it. Like what happens if there's 2-3 and outs to start the game? You know, how does that feel? What kind of tone does that set? But I think that, you know, if Penn State gets through there, you look at that mid stretch of UCLA, USC, the bye week, Wisconsin, Ohio State and Washington. You know, I think that stretch is really, you know, where you learn what this team is. And that's going to determine, you know, what the postseason looks like. If it is a CFP berth, if they are in the mix for the Big Ten championship. And then a little tricky, Minnesota, Purdue on the road in November. Minneapolis and West Lafayette probably aren't, you know, top of the travel destinations for that time of year. So that could get a little interesting. But I just think where Penn State is talent-wise, how this sets up, you know, Ohio State at home even, things really do break right for them this year.
I appreciate you adding UCLA at the beginning of that list of identity games. That was very kind to your hosts, or one of your hosts, but you can probably just skip right past that one to the next game, being more of an identity game for Penn State.
A lot of the publishers we've talked to are the people that cover, you know, the various teams across the Big Ten. The specific circumstances regarding getting rid of divisions is always interesting for Penn State. You know, not having to play Michigan this year is kind of a big deal. I wanted to see what your thoughts on where their fan base is, because if you didn't have the new additions, then it might be a little more interesting. Like, oh, this could be an 11-1 season and just lose to Ohio State and beat everybody else. Now, you know, adding in like Oregon, that looks like, you know, a Ohio State kind of clone right now or whatever. And then, you know, tradition of USC, UCLA, Washington, it was in the national championship game last year. It's sort of like, okay, it's like a little bit of freeing feeling, like, hey, we don't have to play Michigan every year, but then it's like, oh, crap, now all this other stuff is there too. Like, what has been the overall kind of thought from the fan base of where Penn State lands in this new, like, infrastructure or whatever of Big Ten football?
Yeah, I think the fact that the college football playoff expands to 12 at the same time, I think that helps a lot there. You know, I do think that if the playoff was still at four and you made these changes and then, you know, got rid of divisions, it would still kind of be like, okay, there's still a cap, on what can be done, and everything. But, you know, I do think that, you know, knowing that 10-2 can get you into the college football playoff. And, you know, the one thing about tournaments is that once you get in there, you know, kind of anything can happen. You know, and I think that you have a chance and that's kind of where you start from. So, you know, I think that, adding these teams in that are, some pretty high level programs and, can be good, when they're really rolling, it is kind of like, it's going to be hard, but it's hard for everyone now. You look at the SEC, in certain respects, the Big 12, like year by year can be difficult for teams to pick their way through. So it's just kind of how it is for everyone at this point. I think that, the combination of it getting difficult for everyone, but still having that door get cracked even wider with 12 teams and, making a 10-2 season still be something that can get you into the playoffs. I think that softens the blow a little bit there, I think.
Last one for me, but obviously it's a changing game in so many different ways with NIL. And, Ohio State and Oregon get talked about a lot as having these huge budgets and everything. But I'm looking at Penn State, and if you didn't know that NIL and the transfer portal had become a thing, there is almost no deviation in the recruiting classes in the modern time versus 10 years ago. Like, it's top 15 classes pretty much no matter what. How has the program adjusted to the NIL era? What does NIL funding look like for Penn State? Because just looking at the results, I would assume it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think there's been some consternation, behind the scenes, but kind of when you talk to almost any program, there's kind of that feeling that, it's not enough. You need more. I think that football has been in, decent shape. I know that, some stuff got kind of brought out into the open, with basketball a couple of years ago when Micah Shrewsbury left for Notre Dame. And that kind of, opened some people's eyes to how things were going. But, James Franklin's philosophy is to under promise and over deliver. That's kind of the, what he leans back on, when talking about how they approach the portal and with NIL. And I think that kind of shows with the portal classes that they've brought in. It's a lot of guys that they had previous relationships with. Julian Fleming was the, number one player in Pennsylvania in the class of 2020 and picked Ohio State over Penn State. I mentioned Nolan Rucci. He was number one in Pennsylvania in 2021. He picked Wisconsin over Penn State. James Franklin is big on relationships and not really burning the bridges. And so, I think that that's something that Penn State leans on, when it comes to the portal and recruiting, maybe a little bit more than just upfront NIL stuff. AJ Harris and Jalen Kimber, the two cornerbacks who transferred in, they both talked a lot about cornerbacks coach Terry Smith, as someone that they, created a good bond with during the recruiting process. And that really helped them kind of get in, and want to be at Penn State. So, I think that if you ask James Franklin, he'd say what any football coach would say, I want more. We need to do more. We need to be better. But I think that the way that Penn State has approached it has at least made it sustainable for them, as things move forward and everything changes again when the revenue sharing starts.
Last thing for me, and we'll let you go. We appreciate you coming on. Make sure you check out Lions 247 for all the Penn State news and notes, this fall camp and stuff going on. When we talked about the offense, and I just wanted to get on with some Drew Aller a little bit, get your thoughts on, we watched Cam Ward last year at Washington State, and it was kind of unwatchable at times. Like, I don't know if he threw a pass beyond the line of scrimmage, and you're just like, what is going on here? And there's huge expectations for him going to Miami because you've seen what he's been able to do. Obviously, Drew Aller, former five-star, you think that he can do more than what, but a lot of the offense was unwatchable when I was checking it out last year. Is there a lot of optimism that, like, this is really, if this isn't a Drew Aller thing, this was more of a schematic thing or the way the offense was run thing, and with, a more dynamic offense, a new vision, and someone that's going to be able to kind of cater to this quarterback's talents, that's going to be a really potent offense? Because if that's the case, I mean, it seems like that's going to take Penn State a long way. Like, defense up and down a little bit, but the big improvement on offense seems like that's where this is going to, where your bread's going to be buttered for Penn State. How do you feel like that's going to kind of pan out?
Yeah, I mean, this offense, if Penn State wants to get where it's going to go, they need that offense to step up. Even if the defense takes a step back, it's still going to be a good defense. They were historically good last year for Penn State. I think with Drew Aller, I think in this scheme, the idea is to maximize what these players do well know, I think that under Mike Yurcich, it seemed like kind of what we've gotten reading between the lines is that, you know, like they wanted every wide receiver to be able to do every single thing. And if you couldn't do every single thing, you know, you weren't going to get on the field and you weren't going to play. But you had a guy like Amari Evans who has 4.31 speed. Caden Saunders is, you know, can be a kind of a human joystick back there. I think that he's someone when you talk about, you know, the horizontal motion, jet motion, he can really benefit from that. You know, he didn't play too much last year. So, you know, I think that they have these younger guys that, you know, people want to see on the field that, you know, they want to get in there. And I think that the hope is that putting those guys in situations to succeed can help Drew Aller. But at the same time, you know, I think that Aller needs to kind of take that step forward. You know, he took care of the ball last year, 2 interceptions, the longest stretch of, you know, most pass attempts without an interception to start a career in FBS history. But, you know, when you can't force the ball downfield and you can't move it against Ohio State or Michigan, that kind of loses its luster a little bit. So I think the hope is that Aller takes a step forward. They scheme some things up and it just kind of unlocks, you know, what he can do, you know, with this group of playmakers around him.
All right, Daniel, we really appreciate you coming on and talking about Penn State football. This is a team seems tailor-made for the new expanded playoff, which then it goes 8-4 and everyone's going to be like, oh, what happens? Or it goes like 11-1 or undefeated. Like, see, we should have had this before, but no, you can't keep anybody happy. But we really appreciate you coming on, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Daniel.
All right. We're going to switch right in and talk some Iowa football. My buddy David's here. We're not going to talk Caitlin Clark at all. We're going to talk maybe a little with the
snubbed.
I'm going to unmute him before I forget. So I think
did you do this seamlessly this time?
I think this was all seamless.
Wow.
David, can you hear us and everything?
Yeah, I got you guys. How are you?
Pretty good. Not too bad.
So yeah, we're doing great. I'm just amazed at Ryan being able to seamlessly transition from one person to the next without.
I mean, hosting, producing, basically carrying David's, you know, everything around, and then also running the board. Like, it's not easy. So, figure out.
Jack of all trades, man of the people, Ryan, man.
That's so true. So true.
You've been a busy guy over at Hawkeye. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in the Hawkeye athletic world.
Yeah.
Caitlin Clark had to be like, was that phenomena just like absolutely insane for you? Like Twitter and everything, it just must have been crazy.
I mean, the last 4 or 5 years have been nuts covering women's basketball. In addition to everything else going on, I mean, you think about this. I mean, Caitlin Clark's basically doubling up point totals that Iowa football, you know, would love to be putting up. But watching the offensive explosion that she has versus the Iowa offense, it's quite a drastic change. But I've always said it's like you take Iowa basketball, men's or women's offense, and you put it with that defense. I mean, you're looking at a powerhouse dynasty, but it's been crazy. And, you know, I've known her and her family since 10th grade. She's from Des Moines, Iowa. And to watch her go from like 500 Instagram followers to, I think, about 3 million now and kind of take over the world, it's been just incredible to kind of watch unfold.
It's funny. When we were talking to Daniel in the last segment, he was talking about how Penn State's offense was pretty bad last year. And David's like, wait, this is the top 25 offense. I'm like, yeah, and we're talking to Iowa next. So like,
this is how the other half lives. All right, let's dive right into that thing. So Iowa, great defense, famously great defense.
Special teams awesome.
Offense last year, 129th in Bill Connolly's SP+. Famously, the Brian Ferentz, I think it was the drive for 25. Was that correct?
It was the drive to 325. And with all due respect to Bill Connolly, I mean, I don't know what four teams are worse than Iowa's offense as far as advanced analytics goes. You got to disband the program at that point if you're putting up worse numbers than Iowa did last year. I mean, I hate to be that guy, but Eric Gall was the team's leading receiver. Guys, he didn't play past week 5.
Wow.
Okay. So here's what I want to know. Iowa went 10-4 last year. What, and this has been a theme of a lot of these shows, so I'm just going to ask it again, though. Did Kirk Ferentz engage in like human sacrifice at some point? Like, what god did he appease that he can still go 10-4 with the 129th ranked offense?
I don't know, man, but that's why Phil Parker did not win the Broyles Award last year. If he didn't, Iowa City was about to riot. I mean, you got to just – it's unbelievable how just great and consistent that the Iowa defense has been put together. I mean, Jay Higgins had 171 tackles last season, tied the program record for that. He's back for another year. And I've said this too. I mean, yes, they lose Cooper DeJean, but this defense, it really is unbelievable. They return 8 of their 11 starters, including what I think is the best linebacking trio in the country, in Sebastian Castro, Nick Jackson, who's on his sixth year of eligibility as well, and Jay Higgins. I mean, outside of BYU guys, this might be the most experienced and oldest defense to ever play college football. I mean, Iowa's youngest starting defender might be a third-year guy, and that's Xavier Wampa. But there is a sophomore that's also pushing for some playing time. But you have 3 6-year guys starting. You have 5 5th-year guys starting. It really is unbelievable how they kept the place together. And on top of that, too, I don't know how they kept the locker room together, because you have to think about the culture that's in place to have them, like, just the defense have the offenses back when the offense couldn't even sustain a drive. I mean, yeah. I mean, seriously, it's not even about points at this point. It's about, can you get the defense rest so they don't have to go back on the field after 3 or 4 plays, right? And that was a huge thing last year. I mean, I'll even reference the Penn State game last year. Iowa, of course, got shut out in that game. That's when, you know, everything I felt like really started to go downhill for Iowa was at that game. Iowa's defense was on the field for more than 100 plays.
Jeez.
In that game.
Oh, my God.
It's got to be demoralizing, right? Like,
it's I don't know how they won 10 games and how Kirk Ferentz convinced, hey, you guys were so worked last year on defense, how about you come back for another year? And they all of them did outside Cooper DeJean.
Yeah.
So it's you know, optimism, I think, is high right now in Iowa City, but definitely some questions on the offensive front, especially at that quarterback position.
It's one of those things. So USC's defense was historically bad. Everyone wanted to see, like, USC's offense and Iowa's defense together, like national championship kind of thing. But
I want to see Iowa's offense go against USC's defense.
That would have been good, too.
Yeah.
Because
the movable object.
Yeah. It would just been kind of crazy. But obviously, you know, making changes on that side of the ball, it can't get worse. Like, there's no, I mean, it would be, I said that last year about USC's defense, and I think it did get
worse.
Is
everyone knocking on wood?
Yeah. But so what, let everyone know, like, what's changed. And even if you brought in, I mean, they're not bringing in like an air raid type of thing, but if you brought in personnel and coaching to try to like score a bunch of points, that's just not the team philosophy, right? Like, you're not trying to, you're trying to be competent, but not put up a whole bunch of points because you want this team to still be relying on defense and special teams, it seems. But wait, let everyone know like kind of what the changes were for the offseason.
Sure. I think there's a couple notable things. I mean, I've said this last year. I mean, yes, Iowa dealt a horrible hand injury-wise last year. I mean, they lose Luke Lachey. They lost Eric Aull. They lost Cade McNamara. And there was just no depth in the quarterback room. But number one, with all due respect to Brian Ferentz, because he's a great O-line coach, he's a great tight end coach, the tight end you tradition really doesn't lie. But you have a guy now who has actually played and has actually coached quarterbacks. Like, that was the amazing part. It wasn't the fact that Brian Ferentz was the offensive coordinator. It's the fact that they made him a quarterback coach when he's never played or coached the position before. And that's been a big thing for Iowa, is they need quarterback development. So right now you get Tim Lester, the former Western Michigan head coach, who actually has a good resume with them. I mean, he's a standout quarterback for Western Michigan. He's developed guys. He sent wide receivers to the NFL. And then he spent last season as an analyst for the Green Bay Packers. So, you know, I think he's bringing definitely a new play style. I think Kirk Ferentz is finally taking his hands off the offense. And I think that's been number one. Iowa's going to run some more RPOs this season. That's something that they just really have never done. And another thing is, it sounds crazy with how basic you would think this would be. They're going to have pre-snap motion. They're going to have guys moving around. It's not going to be, hey, we're going to do the same thing but better, because that's what happened last year with Brian Ferentz. After they were horrible 2 years ago, we asked him last year what changes are going to be made, and he just said, we're going to do the same thing but better. At that point, it's just like, well, I don't know what's better.
No. Yeah.
And you didn't think they went from second to last, so they couldn't even do it better. So I think right now you're combining pre-snap motion. You have two really, really good tight ends. Luke Lachey, I think, could be up there for the Mackey Award if he stays healthy. He's been a huge help at the as a blocker as well. And then you have the offensive line, who has more than 130 career starts. I mean, this is the year the Iowa offensive line, I think, gets back to where, you know, maybe a decade ago we're thinking about Iowa's offensive line being near the top of the nation. They've had standout linemen. They haven't had a great line in the past several years. And I think that's something that I don't know if they'll be great, but they're going to be better. And then Iowa, just from a running back scheme, they're deep right now. I mean, they'll go four or five guys deep at running back that they feel really good about. I'll be surprised if they don't use three, if not four, every single game. The wide receiver position, we'll see. I think there's some young talent in there. I think they're going to be more than perimeter blockers, as I like to call it, for Iowa. I mean, that's basically what it's been the last couple of years. So they've redesigned the route trees. They're having a lot more pre-snap motion. They're going to be able to do different things to actually try to trick the opponent's eyes instead of saying, hey, guess what? We know you're not passing the wide receivers. We're going to stack 10 in the box, and we know what you're going to run. And we know what you're going to run, and they'll find a way to stop it. I mean, my sister does not watch football at all. Okay, she does not. I remember I was watching a game with her. She predicted an exact string of plays for Iowa's offense. So I'm like, can you imagine what a high-level head coach is doing at this point? So I think there's some optimism that that Iowa's going to be a little bit better on the offensive end. Awesome. And, you know, for my Sandy, I certainly am hoping so as well.
This is great. We were questioning doing a Big Ten podcast at all. This has made it all worth it.
Talking Iowa offense is exactly the kind of slop we wanted to slurp up. All right, we got to talk about the quarterback position because you mentioned all those position groups, but we got to talk about the quarterback. Cade McNamara is coming off two straight seasons, I think, where he suffered a knee injury that more or less ended his season. And then in the game, what's the game called that they just played? The like scrimmage, the kids.
It's the open fall practice. It's the only look we get as a media in the fall as well.
So. And he had a really, really rough day. You also brought in the guy from Northwestern, Brendan Sullivan. Is there any chance that Sullivan ends up taking this, or is it? Are they considering it a one-off where McNamara had a bad practice? What's kind of the deal with the quarterback position right now?
I think if you would have asked Kirk Ferentz a month ago if Cade's the starter, he would have said yes. But he's been very non-committal since we've been able to talk to him since fall camp started. And, you know, the reality is you can't. I mean, he, with all due respect to Cade McNamara, he's the reason why Jim Harbaugh didn't get fired. He kind of really has helped push that run that Michigan was under right now. And we'll see with Sherrill Moore, obviously, there's some question marks. But Cade beat Iowa in the Big Ten Championship. And I think that's what Kirk's kind of, you know, tipped his cap on and kind of said, hey, you know what, he's going to be the starter. But what has he done since he got to Iowa?
Yeah.
There's no credibility with him in an Iowa uniform. On top of that, you have a new offensive coordinator, and you're running a completely new style. And you look at Brendan Sullivan. Now, look, Sullivan, I think, was a capable quarterback at Northwestern. I don't know if he was a star, but I think you kind of put him in this system that Iowa wants to run. Sullivan can do something that Iowa quarterbacks really have not been able to do since C.J. Beathard, and that's be mobile. Get out of the pocket, make some things happen. I mean, Spencer Petras, I think people realize he took way too much crap because of how many other issues there are across the board for Iowa's offense. Yeah. But I think over the last few weeks, I mean, we're seeing Brendan Sullivan. If he's picking up the playbook, I think it's a very real possibility. I'm actually about to host a radio show here in about 25 minutes. I'm calling for Brendan Sullivan to be the starter this season. I mean, if you look at Cade's plays in that scrimmage, and I try not to overreact. It's the one practice. Right. But Kirk also said after the practice, hey, this has kind of been this – it's been very consistent as far as how the quarterbacks were performing. Cade unofficially went 7 of 21, threw a pick six for 20 yards, and six of the completions were checkdowns.
I'm not a math guy, but I think that's less than a yard per attempt.
I mean, I have so many just cheap shots I could take the Iowa offense right now, but it's like beating a dead horse at this point. Everybody knows, right? But I think Brendan Sullivan, I think he's got some good mobility. I think he made good decisions with his arm as far as, you know, the shiz and shoes things he was trying to do. And as far as the fall camp, though, too, I'm of the opinion I really don't look into the stats too much. I look at, okay, what schemes are they running? I see what they're trying to do. Can I see the vision? And I can see the vision. I think they know what they need to do, but it all comes down to, will Kirk Ferentz have the guts to potentially bench Cade McNamara? Because not only that, remember, he really, I think, kicked off the transfer portal last year. He was really kind of that big first splash that, you know, it just took everybody by surprise. But is he going to have the confidence to say, hey, we know you were a captain last year. He might be a captain this year. Will they bench him? I don't know, but I think it's very irresponsible just to give him the job just because he's Cade McNamara, especially when you consider those stats and everything he ran, guys. He's a six-year senior. You have to be able to make good completions.
Yeah. Well, he'd be offensive MVP last year, you know, seven completions. Like, that's great. Like,
Taylor is the team's offensive MVP last year. I'll stand on that.
Yeah, needed him to split the field all the time. I know it's fun to talk about the offensive lab, and you'd mentioned some really interesting facts about the defense. We did have a question in the chat from yet another Duck fan. How much does the Big Ten having mostly awful offenses, specifically in the quarterback department, contribute to Iowa's defensive success and perception?
I think that's definitely a good point, but I'd also point to this. Look at how long Iowa's defenses have been doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it's been a two-year run. I mean, this is something that under Phil Parker, they've really been incredibly consistent. I mean, even Iowa, as far as interceptions go, I think if you go back to the 2017 season, I don't think any team's had more interceptions than Iowa. I know Appalachian State's up there, but Iowa just finds a way to get it done because you also look at this. I mean, Iowa has had six of the last eight, I think, cornerbacks of the year in the Big Ten. I mean, they are just churning out high-level guys. I think Sebastian Castro is going to be the cornerback of the year in the Big Ten this year. I think he's got that type capability. I think he's an All-American. I think it's an interesting point, but I also look at this. I mean, Iowa played three ranked teams last year. The tolls were not good, even on the point. But I also look at this. Iowa's defense was so consistent. They gave Michigan more struggle than any team did. I mean, Michigan didn't blow out Iowa in this year's Big Ten title game, but they only had 210 yards of offense. They had a huge kick return that really set them up. Two of the touchdown drives started inside the 7-yard line. It's not like they had a long way to go. It's because Iowa's special teams faltered when it couldn't, and the offense turned it over where they couldn't. So I think it's definitely a fair point, but I just look at the longevity that Kirk Ferentz has had and the run of great defensive players that they've been able to do. And again, Iowa's defense really isn't that complicated. I mean, you guys have watched them on film. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just they're so dang efficient in what they do. But I am interested now when they go up against Oregon, when they go up against USC, when they go up against these more West Coast-style offenses, will Iowa not only be able to hold up, will they be able to consistently hold up? Because I know some people look back at the USC-Iowa game from 2019. It's a completely different world, and it's also about, hey, you don't have a month to prepare for this. And I'm also interested at the same time, you know, with UCLA, with USC, how are they going to be able to have the offensive success against the Big Ten where – It is a totally different style of football. It's a lot line play oriented, and it's a really, really good defensive teams. So I think it's kind of two sides of the coin. But I'm definitely interested, again, once Iowa plays Ohio State, once they play USC, once they play up against these high-level teams, will they be able to hold up? I think for the most part, yeah. And it's all going to come down to, will the defense be able to have some rest at all?
So looking at the schedule for Iowa this year, it's pretty interesting because it's almost like the Big Ten gave them like a transitional year of still kind of Big Ten Westy scheduling.
Yeah,
they avoid Michigan, Oregon, and Penn State. So three of the top four teams in the league. It seems set up for, I mean, even a Iowa team that's similarly constituted to last year to still end up with a pretty decent record, even in this kind of new league with four new teams. What's your sense of the schedule? What do you think of the make or break games?
Yeah, I mean, I think, number one, I think that Nebraska game is going to be a huge game. I think that's going to separate Iowa from a 9-win season or a 10-win season. I'm actually buying stock in Nebraska for the first time.
Yeah, me too.
In what feels like a decade. I think Matt Rhule's a good coach. I think he's the guy that gets it done. And I'm also going to look at that Iowa State game. Because Iowa State, I'm still buying a little bit of stock into them. And typically when Iowa has big years, they beat Iowa State. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of revenge on the mind of Cyclones, but I'm of also the belief, guys, I know some other Iowa writers feel that way. I think it's a make or break year for Iowa football if they want to make the playoffs under Kirk Ferentz, because I think Kirk Ferentz has a few years left in him. But you look at Iowa's 18 returning starters, but that schedule, Iowa's likely going to be favored in 11 of the 12 games. And I'm of the belief where if Iowa goes 10-2, but they get blown out by Ohio State, they're not making the top 12. Iowa has to compete with Ohio State. They either have to win, which I don't think they will. They have to find a way to make it a four-quarter game because I think the committee would love nothing more than to throw in a 9-3 Tennessee team or a 9-3 Ole Miss team over a 10-2 Iowa team. And the other part of it is I think it's better for Iowa if they don't find a way to weasel their way into the Big Ten championship, because if they get blown out by Ohio State twice, they're not making the playoff. It doesn't matter if they were in the Big Ten championship. But I think you just look at all the returning stars that Iowa has this year. I think the pressure should be on. I think Kirk's been unbelievably consistent. But with the 12-team playoff and that schedule and all that returning stars, I think it's a playoffs or bust, or I think it's a failure of a season.
I was looking at the schedule from last year. David, we cover college football for a while. We cover the Pac-12. Do you remember the last time we covered a shutout? David, do you remember?
Me?
David Woods, sorry.
Me?
Yeah. Was there a shutout in the Pac-12 like since
in the last 3 years? I can't remember one.
I can't remember. Okay. Iowa was involved in four yep. shutouts last year. They shut out Rutgers, but were shut out by Penn State, Michigan, and Tennessee. Like every ranked team, Iowa didn't score a point against a ranked team last year. Is that correct?
True.
In
True.
Three games. Yep. Like how insane is, I know we weren't going to talk about this, but I was just, that was just
a
weird stat for me. Like, I don't remember.
That was funny. I was literally waiting for you to break. I almost brought up one of my answers, but I'm like, I think Ryan's going to hold it down. I think he's going to find a way to sneak that in the conversation.
But involved in four shutouts, even if just those aren't, don't happen in college football.
The last time it happened with a Pac-12 team, I think was Stanford in like 2012, 2013. Like when they had those really, really good teams, that was the last time. Even remotely close to that.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I ran out of ways to describe the offense, guys. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. I mean, what else can you say?
Well, I guess in a different context. So Kirk Ferentz, like from like an outsider perspective, like he's basically like, you know, Iowa's version of whoever. I mean, he's been there forever. He's been there 25 years now. Produced a lot of really, really good teams. What's the fan base impression of him at this point? And like, have Iowa fans like adopted over the years, like, okay, I just like watching good defense. I don't really care about offense. Or are there a lot of them just like clamoring for, please just run a like normal spread offense. Please just run something that I can like actually watch them score points. Or is it kind of, I don't know, Stockholm syndrome at this point?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I think there's still a great portion of the fan base. They're very Kirk Ferentz loyalist. It really doesn't matter. He wins games. He churns out good kids, and they find a way to get things done. But there's also a portion of the fan base that I do believe would be comfortable with losing more games if the product was entertaining. Right. I think there's the two totally different ends of the spectrum, because I also think it sounds really strange, and I got blasted by some Iowa fans about it, but I'll stand by it. Like, Kirk Ferentz at this point with the 12-team playoff and everything, Iowa has to care about style points. They have to find a way just to be, from an entertaining standpoint, when it comes to the playoffs, when it comes to visibility, when it comes to recruiting, Iowa has to be fun. They have to put up some style points. And especially with that schedule, because again, if Iowa goes 11-1 with a blowout loss to Ohio State, they get to the Big Ten championship, they get blown out. Guess what? Iowa's not getting in the playoff. They're putting in Ole Miss. They're putting in somebody else. They'll put in three or four other teams from the Big Ten over Iowa, despite Iowa making the Big Ten championship. So I think at this point, if Beth Getz hadn't stepped in and fired Brian Ferentz and Kirk kept Brian next year, which I don't think was ever a possibility, I think it would have seriously damaged his longtime legacy as far as how he rides off into the sunset. But now the fact that, okay, he's taking his hands off the offense. He's letting the coordinator work. He's going into more of that CEO type role. And if he really lets them run what they want to run, I think right now, I think Kirk's back in, I don't want to say back in good standing, but he's in great standing with some of those fans, I think, were, to be honest with you, a little bit on the edge of wanting him to retire. Because the other side of it is, he's a lifer. Kirk Ferentz, it does not matter what happens. Kirk Ferentz will not be fired. And quite frankly, he deserves to go out on his way and on his terms, especially considering he's still age. I mean, they still find a way to win football games. But definitely with the new age of college football, I've been a little bit surprised about how willing Kirk Ferentz has been to accept it. But you're right. I think there's still a portion of the fan base that is in wait and see mode. I think they're a little bit frustrated with how everything is going. But again, you get Tim Lester. You have all this returning starting experience. There's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. But if Brian Ferentz came back again, I mean, to be honest with you, I was surprised Brian even came back last year, because I know there was a lot of fans that were still just as pent up. But again, there are more issues than Brian Ferentz. There's other stuff that had to be addressed. But without question, I think Kirk Ferentz's loyalty to his son, I think it cost him a few of those, you know, less diehard fans. But there's still a Ferentz loyalist. As far as some portion of the fan base goes.
All right. Well, I know you got to do your radio show. We appreciate you coming on. I got one last quick stat for you. Dave's not an NFL guy. But like, so anyone out there play fantasy football, like, you know, George Kittle, like, obviously, absolute stud, catches balls all over the place. 49 career games as an Iowa tight end, 48 career catches. How about that?
Yep.
That's pretty amazing.
It's crazy with Kittle, though, too, because so that was before I started covering this. I could start covering the team in 2018, but I've talked to people about the Kittle thing. Kittle was hurt a lot during his Iowa career as well, but he also didn't get offered by Iowa until signing day. I mean, he was a very undersized wide receiver from Oklahoma, got to Iowa. I think hit the party scene a little bit too hard his first couple of years, but then found a way to really dedicate himself to football. And shocker, right? You've seen George Kittle. I'm shocked that he was partying a little bit when he got to Iowa City. But, you know, he put on about 45, 50 pounds, still struggle with some injuries here and there. But to watch the way he's had success has been really kind of incredible. And he does. I think he credits Kirk Ferentz a lot for really kind of getting him on track to where he needed to be. But, yeah, it is kind of crazy when you look at that, too, just considering Kittle kind of set the market for tight ends at this point. But, again, it's amazing watching Iowa football because you get Tristan Wirfs, you have Tyler Linderbaum, you have all these great tight ends. But what's everybody talk about now, and rightfully so, over the past 4 years or so, it's about Iowa's offense. And when Brian Ferentz was the offensive coordinator, he had no offense finish better than 87th, and that was in the COVID year.
Wow, pretty crazy. Kittle did have 10 career touchdowns at Iowa, so he did. He got some red zone.
Yeah, you put some respect on their name.
Well,
yeah.
I think they would call that a specialist. My parents called Noah Fant a specialist, and that really teed off a lot of people.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate sharing some. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, it'll be fun to watch Iowa again. Like they sort of get a break. Like you thought some of the West teams, they're going to be like playing all the top teams, and Iowa still gets a little bit of a break. So it'll be fun to watch, you know. And
the reality check will come next year. I looked at that next year's schedule with everything Iowa's potentially replacing. I mean, at least I got storylines to write about.
Yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, Iowa fans, don't look at the 2025 schedule. Stay right here at 2024.
Live in the moment. Yeah. Live in the present.
Good stuff. All right, David, thanks so much for coming on, man. We'll talk to you soon. Go have fun on the radio show.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks,
appreciate
Dave.
All right. Everyone else, we'll be back in a second. We'll take a quick break. All right. Good stuff.
That was great stuff.
I mean, heavy hitters, Penn State and Iowa.
Yeah.
Our new conference, the Big Ten.
Our new conference.
They both could make the playoff.
Yes.
Both have easier schedules.
Yes. I've got Penn State in the Big Ten title game with Oregon.
Wow. Yeah. Over Ohio State.
Ohio State has to play everyone. Like, they got to play a lot of teams.
But they like added like everybody too. They got a lot of.
Yeah, I mean they're going to be really good, but they also added Chip Kelly.
That's
a knock. That's a drawback. And Michigan's going to take a step back. So I think the stage is set for Penn State because they're really good. I mean they bring back a ton. Yeah. I think they're going to be very very good this year. And then Iowa again. Kirk Ferentz made a deal with a witch doctor at some point. And they
have to pay up at some point.
They are able to win games while scoring 7 points of offense.
Yeah. Four shutouts last year.
That's insane. Stanford did something like that. I want to say it might have been earlier. It might have been like 2009 or 10, but they did something like that.
Yeah. Cam says, man, we got graphics. Sheesh, what's going on here? I do graphics. I put up stuff. Like I try to do B-roll while we're hosting the show of pictures of what's going on with the team, or I try to do the schedules. And Alan says, excellent content. Well, thanks, Alan.
Alan seems like a new listener.
Appreciate that. We're trying to do the excellent content thing. We didn't really get the spiel up at the top. But, you can email us questions. I know we got some questions to get to. Mm-hmm. Big10cast@gmail.com. Call or text us at 424-532-0678. Leave us a voicemail. We had a really fun one from the Zodiac Killer. Someone the resident Rutgers fan. Someone brought that up in the beginning of the chat. We are live on YouTube, so thank you for tuning in while we were interviewing. Oh, we got 50 people in live right now. It's not bad. Thank you for watching us live or watching the replay on YouTube. And then, of course, wherever you get your podcasts, you can listen to the show. We should be everywhere. But if you have the Apple Podcasting app or Spotify, there's place where you can leave us a 5-star review. And we really ask you to do that because it helps to grow the show. And if you have that iPhone and you want to leave us a fun review, you can make fun of us. We love to appreciate, we would appreciate that as well. It's always great. Do we have any new ones?
We have a new review.
Ooh.
This is from Mattman 19044, 5-star review. Style differences. Would love your take on whether the Pac-12 alums will have superior offenses to the Big Ten, or will the big defenses stop the high-powered offenses? Also, I have placed several wagers that two of the top four teams in the Big Ten will be Pac-12 alums. Thoughts? We've talked about the style differences a lot, and I think our big takeaway at this point is we just don't know. I think it's it comes up a lot in these conversations we're having with the different publishers where they don't know either. I mean, I think Iowa just talked about it, Penn State talked about it, but how will these Pac-12 teams with their high-powered offenses and generally good quarterback play contend with these big, deep defensive lines in the Big Ten? And yes, is there an advantage to be had for Pac-12 defenses who weren't otherwise very good against bad Big Ten quarterback play and, mediocre offensive coaching a lot of times? Sure. But will that be offset by whatever, you know, these Big Ten teams are able to do to the Pac-12 offensive lines? We just don't know.
Yeah. It's a mix in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. Probably depends on the relative quality of these different things. I do think it'll change things though. I don't think it's going to be like, 50-50. I think there is going to be one that kind of wins out a little bit, and that's going to determine maybe the future of a lot of these teams, whether the Pac-12 teams have to adjust and add a lot more depth on the defensive line, or whether it's Big Ten teams having to really emphasize quarterback play in a way that they maybe haven't in the past. And then the second question, he's got two of the top four teams in the Big Ten will be Pac-12 alums, and I'm wondering who the other one would be. USC?
It would have to be, I think, because Washington lost a lot, so they must be high on USC, which...
I could squint and see it, but I see USC more as being, like, top third being the ceiling, like getting into the fifth or sixth spot.
Yeah, we'll see. They're picked fifth or...
They just have so far to go defensively.
Yes.
And that's... I mean, Danton Lynn was able to do it with UCLA overnight, where they went from, like, 100th to 25th, but... Doing that 2 years in a row, and do they have the right mix of parts? I think they're going to be better on defense, but they also might be quite a bit worse on offense.
Yeah, they can't take a big step back. But Lincoln Riley's never really had anything outside of like a top five kind of offense. So we'll see if they're like top 15 and they only like slightly improve on defense. No, but if they're still like a top 10-ish offense and they get into like the 40s, like then they can win a whole bunch of games. So we'll see. But yeah, but thank you for the review. We appreciate that. I do want to let everyone know, so wherever you are on the 24/7 Sports Network, you can sign up for a VIP membership because we're getting into the season, 30% off. And I've been working with a new company called Autograph. Tom Brady, who's Big Ten, was one of the founders of it. But you can go to ag.fan and download the app, and you can get all of our content. A lot of the 247 content will be up on that app. And if you use the code USC, obviously you do that through the USC one, but you can do that. You can check out podcasts and all kinds of other stuff over on the Autograph app. They have a little scoring system, so you can get, like, if you want to get price true fan pricing on tickets or merchandise or memorabilia. So I think they're adding, I think most of the schools are in there. Michigan, I know, is a big one. They start out there. They started with USC, and I think they're adding a lot of the other Big Ten schools. So if you want to go check out Autograph, ag.fan, and if you download the app, you can use promo code USC to get it. So let you guys know about that. We got the AP poll that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at this yet?
I have looked at the AP poll.
So you have to look for a Big Ten lens. Georgia's number one. Not too much of a surprise, but Ohio State – number two, and Oregon, number three. So two Big Ten teams in the top three. You got Penn State coming in at number eight, and just ahead of Michigan, who comes in at number nine. You got to go down a little bit more. Then you got USC at number 23, and Iowa's coming in at number 25. So that's where the Big Ten schools are ranked in the AP poll. Do you care? Do you agree? What do you think?
I don't care. And I mostly agree. I mean, I think I would have Penn State a little bit higher. I'd maybe have Michigan a teensy bit lower. USC I wouldn't have ranked. Iowa I wouldn't have ranked. I'd probably have Nebraska maybe hugging at 25. Just, I think a lot of times what happens with the AP poll and a lot of these preseason polls, and it's nobody's fault, but they're basing it off of last year. And that's fine. There's a lot of value in looking at last year's results, but a team like Nebraska returns so much. Their schedule's softer. Like, if you're looking at the AP poll as not where teams should be ranked right now, but where we would think they would be by the end of the year, I think you would have Nebraska at the bottom end of the top 25 and maybe not USC or Iowa.
For others receiving votes, Washington had 23 votes, so that would have been like 31 or 32 or something. And then Nebraska and Wisconsin also had a few votes. They'd be like in the high 30s or 40 or something.
Weirdly, UCLA not receiving votes.
No votes for UCLA this Strange. Year. Colorado got a vote.
Hey, look at them.
Former Pac-12 teams, you got Utah would have been the highest. That's not in the Big Ten. They're coming in at 12.
Yep.
But a lot of SEC teams. You got Georgia 1, Texas 4, Alabama 5,
Arizona coming in at 21st.
Yeah. And Notre Dame, one of USC's opponents, they're at 7. They don't really have a tough schedule and stuff. But yeah, Arizona 21, Kansas at 22. Yeah, so we'll see. Not a lot of group of five representation. Where's the first group of five? Boise State would be 28, it looks like, and then SMU 29.
That's the first G5? Damn.
Yeah, I don't think they have any G5 in the – so just so you guys know, this year too, playoff-wise, the highest-ranked group of five team will get in, and the four highest-ranked conference champions, which are probably going to be – SEC, Big Ten, ACC, and Big 12, they get the top four and they get a bye. But there's a lot of arguments that number five could actually be a little bit better because you end up playing, you know, probably the group of five team coming at number 12, and then the champion of the weakest conference, you know, the four seed. So, because you could have the number four seed could be out of the top 12, you know? So like if the Big 12, like sort of beats up, everyone gets beat up and your Big 12 champions like 9-3, maybe they're like 12th or 13th, but they get the number four seed because they're the fourth highest ranked conference champion. Mm-hmm. So that five spot, you get an easier game, theoretically just playing the 12 and you host it. And then you'd get to play the four. So, which that could be like, you know, not even in the top 10.
A 12-team playoff is very stupid. We all agree.
This is an interesting way to do it. And I think you might end up screwing like the top seeds a little bit.
It's a very stupid way to run a playoff.
Yeah.
Ryan, I have a question for you. When USC goes 6-6 or 7-5 this year, will Lincoln Riley be on the hot seat entering next season?
Okay, so what are you saying? If USC goes what?
When USC goes 6-6 or 7-5 this year,
okay,
will Lincoln Riley be on the hot seat entering next season?
No. So I think there would be tremendous pressure on Lincoln Riley if that was the case, mm-hmm. if that's what they do. But he also has a massive, massive contract. And
I love that we're at the stage now where it's not his resume, it's not the things he's done in the past, it's just the albatross of a contract that's hanging around his neck.
I think you will go all in to hire – USC's never hired someone like that. I think Chip Kelly was the same thing, right? Like UCLA
– I like how you've come to terms with that now.
No, but they hadn't hired someone like Chip Kelly. Like he was a proven
Ryan
winner.
Abraham, quote, Chip Kelly was the same thing referring to Lincoln Riley. Let's get that quoted
out of
period. Boom.
UCLA had never hired a proven head coach. I mean, okay, outside of Carl Durrell, who was in the top half of the NFL as far as wide receiver coaches go, like you can't pass on a guy.
Was
like
he
that.
Though?
But I think like when USC hired like Howard Jones in like the 20s, who won a national championship at Yale, like that was the last time they hired someone that was like successful college head coach before. So you had to go all in on him. I don't know the details of the contract, but I know some of them. And it's not good as far as, like, if you wanted to fire him after 4 years, it would cost a lot of money. So I don't think USC would put him on the hot seat. He would probably be a lot of pressure going into the Big Ten.
Do you think he would consider maybe taking an offensive coordinator role for a fellow Big Ten team at that point?
Say
Michigan?
I don't think so.
Or maybe Ohio State will have an opening.
I think if he leaves, it would be like an NFL job. But that means USC has to be good. Like,
right.
If they're mediocre, I don't think the NFL would hire him. And I don't think USC would get rid of him.
And then maybe he'll go begging for jobs starting in November of next year and look at a variety of different schools, including talking to Kirk Ferentz for Iowa. And then maybe even looking at the Boston College head coaching job, Seahawks, Bears, all of their offensive coordinator jobs, and then eventually land at a position, maybe at, I don't know, some school where he has a buddy who he previously coached at some point.
I'm not sure that would be the exact career
path. You don't
think
so? Oh, okay.
But that sounds like an interesting... I mean, that seems
That seems unlikely,
plausible.
Right?
Yeah,
like, who would do that?
It doesn't seem like that. That's very fictionalized.
Like, you have a Power 4 job in a major market, like Los Angeles, for example, and you would decide to leave for an offensive coordinator position at a conference mate? That seems odd.
Yeah, I don't think that would happen. Like, that's not reasonable.
No, it seems crazy.
Yeah, good stuff. So what if he got the Iowa job? Like, what would you think of Iowa?
If Chip Kelly was the coach for the offensive coordinator for Iowa?
Because his run schemes are very, very good.
At Iowa, I think he would be a massive upgrade.
Yeah.
At Ohio State, I am not convinced he's going to be an upgrade over what they were doing previously.
Okay.
But at Iowa, yeah. I mean, you add Chip Kelly to that, I think they would immediately jump into the top 100. But it might be a long road after that because what he runs now requires a big learning curve. But even just, you know, I mean, he can kind of, you know, put together a run offense from chewing gum and baling wire.
Yeah. And Iowa would love a good run offense.
Yep.
So good stuff there. Okay. Should we get to... questions?
Let's get to some questions.
I think so. Is there anything else?
We've got Eric first. I think that's it.
Okay.
All right. Ryan and Judge Doom. This is from Eric in Philadelphia. I'm listening to last week's episode and Ryan's take on what transit should be. Did he watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit and come away thinking Judge Doom had good ideas? Unfortunately, Dave is correct. What a great... I should have that on my tombstone, right?
Unfortunately, Dave is correct.
Unfortunately, Dave is correct, and we'd need a time machine to get a proper system in L.A., but that doesn't mean L.A. can't still invest in transit infrastructure to try to take some cars off the road and making it a little less congested for those driving. Keep it mediocre. Eric in Philadelphia. I don't know what you said about transit anymore. It was 5 full days ago. However, I will say... there's a lot to this. So originally when they were building the freeways, they were all intended to have light rail in the middle of them. So like all the freeway systems, and the only one that currently does is the one that was built most recently, which is the 105.
Yeah.
But they were all intended to originally have that, which would also mitigate some of these issues. Why didn't that happen? Because once again, General Motors, oil companies, tire companies, car companies, all of them together conspired to make it so these things can't happen. That's why we don't have public transit in LA that works. Yeah, that's it. But I mean, I guess you could figure out a way to try to add some streetcars and stuff again, but you would be taking away lanes of traffic, especially in like on side streets. There's no way to do it anymore because everything is so impacted. Now you should do that. And just tell people to get on the friggin' bus or get on the train or get on the trolley or whatever it is. But they're never going to. So, yeah.
Yeah.
We're just stuck with what we've got.
Eric's in Philly. I'm not listening to your takes on LA traffic, Eric. You're in Philly, first of all. With the Olympics, the mayor, Karen Bass, is saying she wants a carless 17 days in Los Angeles. And she's asking employers to say you can all work from home for 17 days, which obviously that's not
correct. I want to go to the end of a rainbow and find a pot of gold at the end of it.
I would love that. She's like, well, we'll use buses. Like, can you imagine the insane? Like,
I would like it if the clouds were actually made out of marshmallow and it was perspective, but you could actually reach up and grab them.
Yeah.
And then just grab some marshmallow and eat it.
It's absolutely insane what she's saying, but
what if candy rained from the sky instead of water?
Yeah.
Know that episode of The Simpsons where everything is made out of chocolate suddenly? Like, that's basically what we're doing.
It's like Willy Wonka kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I would love that.
Yeah, Karen Bass is high if she actually thinks that's possible. There's no way you can do that.
A carless Olympics in
4 years. If you were planning 20 years ago for an Olympics in 2028, you might have been able to figure out a way to do it. But there is no fucking way they're going to be able to do that.
Yeah. I think you do need, like, I think there's things you can do, which, what you're talking about, to invest some time in the transit infrastructure, take some cars off the road. I think you can do some reasonable things to accomplish that in 4 years. To say carless in 4 years is insane. Like, of any city in the country, we are a car city. Maybe it's for the reasons David said, whatever, like big oil and all this stuff. They're like, yeah, we don't want public transit. I lived in the Bay Area for a while, you know, shortly after like the earthquake stuff was happening in like the 90s. LA lost the 10 freeway for a while. They worked on that for 6 months straight, 24 hours a day, and got it back up. I think it was the 880 for like the big earthquake up in the Bay Area, like the baseball one. And I don't think they ever even brought it back. Like in Northern California, they're still trying to like get away from cars. But LA, you just can't. Like anything that happens, there was a big fire from a homeless encampment under the 10 freeway a year or two ago. And they got that thing back up and running like super fast. And like everyone knows, you need all these freeways for LA to exist. So to say carless in 4 years is insanity.
I mean, unless she truly intends to like basically invest $1 trillion in LA's infrastructure and build an entire public transit system from essentially scratch, but that's not going to happen. Mm. Like to do that, I mean, when you talk about it, it is, I mean, essentially the way it is and it's how it's got to be. But like talking about the freeways, like this wasn't a designed plan to basically get people entirely dependent on cars. Well, it was, and they crushed literally the company that was in charge of all of this bought all the streetcars and then disbanded them and turned them into buses because they want, you know,
yeah,
the company that supplied the buses was General Motors. But that was all 80 years ago, and unless you're planning to fix something that happened 80 years ago, Karen Bass, it's going to be a car full Olympics.
Yeah. We're going to have cars.
Yeah, lots of cars. Now, maybe you'll be able to do like drive them all to like some big lot and then have people bus in from there to wherever you want them to be. Yeah. But that's about all you can hope for.
James said in the chat, during the 84 Olympics, traffic was great. 2 weeks of free flow traffic. It may never happen again. I wasn't here then, but I'd read about that they thought it was going to be Armageddon traffic wise. And it wasn't that bad. So yeah, maybe there's some.
There's a great video of people driving in LA from the 1980s, and there's this video I saw one time, and it was so surreal. It was somebody leaving like South LA at 4 p.m. on a Friday and driving to Sepulveda Pass, and not experiencing a single slowdown, and it's because there were a lot fewer people here then. And so in the Olympics in 84, yeah, there were a lot of people who came to town, and I'm sure people were expecting the traffic to be bad, but traffic in LA is now, an abomination. Like it's the worst thing you can imagine. And it's because there are millions and millions and millions of more people.
Yeah. There is a lot.
Than there were then. But anyway, that's enough about public transit.
Yeah.
This is a
college football
show.
Is it really?
Judge Doom.
We have a, from West Texas Mike in Las Vegas, Jesus Christ is the subject, or J-E-Z-U-S. At this point, when someone asks whether the former Pac-12 teams can compete with, and he gives a bullet list, the physicality of the Big Ten, the impassioned fan bases of the Big Ten, the inimitable marching bands of the Big Ten, the unsurpassable coronary artery diseases of the Big Ten. Can we just tell them to F off? It's too much. They're wearing me out already.
We can't tell them to F off yet. And also, this is a Big Ten show. We love you.
Yeah.
We can't tell them to F off yet, but it will be interesting to see how the season goes. It'll be interesting to see how Oregon does. It'll be interesting to see how USC does in Washington and UCLA. If they do better than expected, then I think you can feel free to say, fuck off.
Yeah. Oh, hey, real quick, our buddy Matthew in the chat says Stanford had three conference shutouts in 2010.
There we go. 2010. Thank you, Matthew.
I'm going to Google, while you read this next one, I'm going to Google college football shutouts. Like, has there been many?
Yeah. This is from Crispy Bruin. Your car warranty has expired. DJ David and the Big Rye Ham. Compliments on your suitably off the rails podcast this past week. Hopefully this new spark for the show helps to rekindle your clearly faltering relationship. Since DDW put out a call for a Civil War themed backdrop, I've shirked my work duties for 15 minutes to slap together two images for your consideration in this primarily audio based medium. Are you able to save these and then post them as on the show?
Oh, probably not. No, let me see.
You can't do them that quickly. I think just number one is probably the best one.
All right, I'll try this.
Yeah. Now on to the main event. He'll get that ready. Now on to the main event. With the chili-fied closing ceremony passed, we have officially begun a new Olympic cycle. Given that the host nation in 2028 will have automatic berths for all events, inquiring minds demand to know. You have 4 years to train. Fate of the universe on the line. The Martians have the death beam pointed at Earth. What's the one LA28 event you would be able to qualify for? Obviously, no one expects you to medal, what with the high level of athleticism required for Olympic competition. But if it's do or die, what sport is getting you a ridiculous Ralph Lauren uniform? Keep it weird, Crispy Bruin. I know my answer. It's very easy.
What's your answer?
Shooting.
Yeah, I would probably have to go. Because, like,
you'll be 57.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, I'd be best at beach volleyball, like, the most competitive, but I would not be, like.
No. So it can't be anything that requires quick twitch athleticism of any sort.
Yeah.
Like, it cannot be, because that doesn't get better as you get older.
No.
I'll be 42. You'll be 57.
It's got
to be shooting.
I could do golf.
Archery?
Yeah.
Like a skill, like a game, essentially. I can do one of those. But there's no way. No sport.
Not breakdancing. No. Like in theory, I guess I could take like golf lessons up the wazoo and like.
No, but there's no chance that you're. Yeah, you're never gonna, no chance that you're making the team.
Right. Well, we're not making the team on anything. The only thing
could make it, like, if you did nothing for the next 4 years but shoot, like target practice with a pistol, you don't think you could get good enough that you could qualify for the Olympic team?
I'm okay at that now. The funny thing, like, and I don't, unfortunately, you see stories and you don't know if they're real. Like, I didn't watch shooting, but the guy from Turkey, like, who just came in, and everyone, the shooting people have, like,
yeah,
it looked like RoboCop.
Yeah, no, all this he just walks up with a t-shirt and jeans on or whatever.
Pocket, boom, boom, and gets a silver medal. Like, that really happened, right? This isn't just AI thing that I've seen in, correct, like, my feeds. So that actually happened?
Yeah.
So that gives you hope that you could do something like that.
Well, obviously, that's the one we would have to pick. Like, you can talk about beach volleyball all you want. There is no way.
No, but what I'd be best at?
Like, well, it's not what you would be best at. It's what you would have the best chance of qualifying at.
Yeah. So here, I'm putting the...
Like, I'm best at... I mean, is ping pong still an Olympic sport?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm best at ping pong, but I'm not going to beat anyone at ping pong.
No, those guys are insane.
Yeah.
The stuff that they do. I got the picture up of us as Civil War generals.
Beautiful.
Am I signing? I think you're the North.
Yeah.
Signing the paperwork there.
Yeah. I think you're Robert E. Lee here, and I am Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah. Oh, and then the victory bell is there. Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys can see that if you're watching on... YouTube.
I think we need to make that some sort of like off-season logo or something. We need this for that.
An off-season logo?
Yeah, like this being our, like, you know how we have the POC in the off-season?
Oh, yeah.
Make this the new one.
And there's one that he has one with Chip Kelly is signing away.
Yeah.
For Ohio State. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Beautiful. All right. So those are our answers regarding Olympics.
Okay. And then I think, we have one new one.
Matthew.
Think. It just came in like an hour ago. Yep. Nice. A plethora of comments and questions. All right. So this is Matthew. During the Olympics, NBC aired a promo for Big Ten Saturday night and blared out, quote, new teams, which included two images of USC, two of Oregon, and one of Washington. That seems like four images, but okay. No question. Just wanted to see if I could make Dave get angry. Mm. Oh, because the UCLA was not included.
Two images of USC, two of Oregon, and one of Washington, none of UCLA.
Ah, yeah. All right. Well, they're both in Los Angeles, so maybe it counts the same.
They are in LA with USC, which is also in LA.
Yeah. So there's that.
Uh-huh.
Next bullet. Last week, you were discussing what to do during the Olympics in four years. Oh, we are having an earthquake right now.
Real one.
Ooh. Live earthquake, baby.
Ooh.
It's a... Okay, rolling.
That's a pretty substantial
one. Let me put in the... this is not small.
That's a substantial
I don't know if you get any shake in the... I'm doing the overhead cam.
I'm going to call it... I think that was a 6.2 in Fontana.
Wow, I love that you're doing this. I'm going to tweet out that we were like... Too bad we didn't have the Midwesterners on during this. Like,
yeah, that would have been something for them.
Live earthquake on the show. What do you follow to see what the earthquakes are?
I don't know.
You don't follow like QuakeBot or some of that stuff?
Nah, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm not soft. I'm from this town.
I'm just tweeting this out so people know. That's cool. I don't know if I've done live earthquake coverage before. So we are in Redondo Beach, California, if you are wondering or care. And it was, it lasted longer than like a, not a very hard jolt to start. It was more a rolling sensation. Would that be correct, David?
I would describe that as a rolling earthquake without a big explosive jolt. Yes.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of an aftershock right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see if anyone in the chat has what the earthquake information is. Okay, I'll keep going. He says, okay. Oh. Well, I think we read all this. Okay. So this was what would you do? Last week you were discussing what to do during the Olympics in 4 years when they come to the heart of Big Ten country. Especially if you have kids, go all in. Bring your kids to as many events as possible. Let them get the full experience. During the last LA Olympics, my family decided to escape the city. So instead of going to events, we just watched them on TV all day from 500 miles away. The only upside is I still get to hold this over my parents 40 years later. All right.
I think the big trick here actually is to buy tickets to all of the finals that you can get access to and then scalp them.
I was thinking about that because I saw stuff buy tickets already.
Yeah.
So should we start buying tickets?
We probably should.
Yeah.
Let's start
maybe as a show.
Let's build a fund to buy as many tickets to the finals as we can that we can then resell.
Yeah. Okay. So what about the survivor pool? I'm willing to take it on again, but given that there are more teams than regular season weeks, 14, I'd like to propose some modifications. I actually was thinking about you, Matthew, the other day. I'm like, one, should we do this at all? And two, how the hell do we do it with 18 teams? He says, we run the survivor pool for 15 weeks, including the conference championship game. Now you have to save a pick for your best team if you want to go all the way. Not only do you pick a winner each week, but you also pick a loser each week. Same rules apply as to the winner with one exception, which is that everyone gets a pass if no team loses in a particular week, like the Pac-12 in week one last year. You could pick a winner and a loser from the same game. But this way, you can't cruise to the finish by simply picking against Northwestern, the Stanford of the Midwest, each week during conference season. Thoughts? Also, I'd like to request a 200% raise for my compensation. Thank you very much, Matthew from Mountain View. I will approve the 200% raise right now.
Yeah, we can do that.
For sure.
I've consulted the books. I've looked at our budget, and we can definitely do a 200%.
You got it, Matthew. And I kind of like that.
Does that mean he has to buy us two buffet lunches each at
Yes. And maybe we won't be so hungover that we can actually taste it.
Our compensation agreement, at least as far as I understand at this point, is you paying you bringing us to a buffet lunch.
Yeah.
That's our compensation agreement for your employment.
And that was an amazing buffet lunch.
That was so delicious.
We were both we were both very hungover, I think, at the time.
Yes, we were. Number two here, also picking a loser. I don't mind it theoretically. I do think it might be complicated for people to understand what they're supposed to do every week.
Yeah.
So,
and Matthew, the ones that he would like tally all this stuff.
Yeah, it might be It might not be complicated for Matthew, but it might be complicated for people filling it out every week. Like
if
knowing
we had
what
to
they're
do it,
supposed
it'd be complicated
to do
for us, but Matthew could handle it.
Yeah, Matthew's got it locked down.
We can't even get people that are like winning to like,
continue to put in their picks every week.
Yeah,
to,
just for
the winners.
But I don't know. It might be fun, and I think we'll have an expanded audience. And once they realize the prizes that,
all right,
we don't give.
Okay, let's just do that. Let's do what Matthew says.
I trust the Stanford guy.
All right, picking a winner and a loser each week. All right, Matthew, you have our go ahead. Let's do it, and we'll announce it on the show and post it on our. Wait, we don't have a blog anymore.
No,
this is what we needed a blog for.
What the content we put, like, it's just gonna go up on 247, you know.
Okay,
I mean, I don't know, that's what.
All right, fine, we'll have people go to the website that we work at. That's fine.
Is that better?
Yeah, probably.
I think it's better because then maybe it'll be shared.
It will be shared.
So I create the content item on uscfootball.com, but David can put it up on Bro in the UCLA skin, and whoever our guests are, they could put it in their own skin. So it can go, it'll be across the network, so anyone can.
I love you calling it skin. Put it in their skin.
But just so it looks.
Hideous way to describe it.
I don't know. That's just the way it.
Yeah.
If you go to Bro, you want it to look like it says Bruin Report Online at the top and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same content, we just have a different skin. That's what they used to call it at Scout, I think, or maybe Rivals. I don't know.
Yeah,
I've been a part of a bunch of networks. No one said what the earthquake was.
It was a 4.7 magnitude earthquake taking place in South Pasadena.
Oh, okay. So what are we, 20 miles from or 25 miles from Pasadena, you think?
I mean, a lot of people are saying it was big the way they felt it.
Yeah, it could be closer to the surface. So it was, but we felt it pretty good here. And it lasted a significant amount of time, like above average duration. And you know, I don't know if you got to see it in the if you're watching on YouTube, but
yeah
good stuff. All right, anything else?
I have nothing else.
I think
I'm
we're good.
Spent.
I am spent too. That was a lot of good stuff.
That was some great stuff.
We have four teams left. We have Wisconsin.
All right, let's do them. Wisconsin, Michigan State, Purdue,
and Northwestern.
Wow. Okay. So we're going to try to do, those publishers willing, Michigan State and Wisconsin next week. And then we don't have publishers for Purdue and Northwestern. 247 doesn't have publishers for them. So we are instead going to get some other guests to talk about both of them. And that'll probably be a little bit shorter. And we'll get into game week previews that week too.
Yeah.
So we'll have a lot to discuss.
All righty. Well, thank you guys for... tune in. Hope you guys all enjoyed the show, and we will talk to you next time.
Goodbye.